This is a Pinball News production.
I work on pinball machines. It's a very odd calling. There's a lot of people that work on them, but not that many people. That's their primary gig, that they do it for a living. And it's almost what I've learned after doing a few of these talks is it's almost impossible to give one that's well-tailored to a broad audience. And that we had opportunity to deliver a game that was sold at an auction earlier this year. And I believe it was the woman's first pinball machine she'd ever bought. And we opened it up, and I was pointing out this and that and the other thing to her and asked if she had any questions. She said, yeah, how do you turn it on? And my friend who was with me realized at that point, it's like, there's you're way over ahead. There's this complete spectrum of people who have who again don't know how to turn it on, and people who their question is, okay, I've got a game and it's doing this, and I've already checked A, B, and C, and what do I do next? And because of that, he created what he called the one-page manual, which he's now distributing at the auctions, which is just it's a very generic one-page manual that he now gives out. Just start a guide here, plug it in, turn it on, here's the basics. Guess what? It opens. A lot of people, I get there to work on the game, and, you slide the glass off and raise it playfield, and they're like, a miracle has occurred. Look at this. I've been trying to work on it through the door. And so there's, a complete spectrum. So anyway, that's what we learned was it's difficult or useless to try to maybe you could do more than one talk in the future where this is the hardcore technical stuff and this is the just beginner stuff. But how many people own a pinball machine? Is there anybody that doesn't own a pinball machine? Anybody? Get to work. There's some for sale out there. Yeah. How many people have one that doesn't work or at least has some problem? Good. Okay. I guess one thing I want to do is encourage people and just let them know you can fix your own machine. If it takes mostly just determination, information, and perseverance. I mean, just being very, very, very stubborn has fixed many things for me, and just deciding that I was going to fix it no matter what. Having said all that, I guess one thing I want to do, I've done these in the past and there's never been enough time for questions at the end. If anybody has a question, we can start with them now just to see if there's, so they won't get left off at the end. Does anyone have a question before we even start? Before I sit in? What is it?
What's the proper way to clean them, clean the contacts, and what's the right stuff, wrong stuff to use?
Wrong stuff to use, okay. When you say clean them, did you mean just the contacts or other parts of the machine as well?
Well, my friend says, well, you're supposed to use WD-40. I wouldn't
use WD-40 anywhere except on a leg leveler to get it when it's rusted in place. Spray some of that in there, come back the next day or an hour later, and you can break it loose. It was designed for to keep things from rusting or to penetrate rusted things like that. You could store pinballs. Spray some on the pinballs if you're going to store them for a long time and, seal them up in a bag and they won't rust. But it's not, you don't want to use it as a lubricant or anything like that. On the playfield, the modern playfields, the manufacturer recommended Novus, which is actually a plastic polish, which turns out to be very, very good on many, many other things. It's great on ramps. It's your basic, liquid sand. Very, very. It's like toothpaste. It's a very, very, very fine abrasive sort of in a paste, like a lot of good car waxes have to some extent. It's great on many things. I'll use Windex on any glass, and I'll use Novus on playfields. It seems to work very nicely on even the pre-diamond-plated playfields. Around 1990, they came up finally with a playfield finish that wouldn't wear out. Within reason. It wouldn't wear out within a couple of years and look like you needed to replace your game, which is another thing my friend credits with the demise of pinball, is that they're games that never get old. You can have a game that's 15 years old and looks like a brand new game. But the Novus is very good there. A lot of people like to put down a coat of some expensive wax over the Novus. They'll use the Novus to clean it and then get a good Carnauba wax or something to go in the play field afterwards. I do a lot of cleaning with the Novus, actually. Ronsonol lighter fuel is very good for cleaning up sticky things. Actually, WD-40 isn't bad for that either if you're desperate in a pinch. It's good. You get somebody had some tape on the lockdown bar or something, you can use that. But what's wonderful about the Ronsonol is it generally won't hurt inked surfaces. So if you have like a you know, the ball arch has all the screened artwork, and it's, you know, 30 years old, and you got this paint that maybe is even getting a little chalky. It's very good at taking off that you know, that decal that said operated by, you know, whoever the operator was, without hurting the paint at all, if you're patient and use your thumbnail to scrape at it gently. Oh, yes, the Novus comes in 1, 2, and 3. 1 is like water, 2 is just right, and 3 is like toothpaste coming out of the bottle. And the 3 is the grittiest. And the idea is, if you had a piece of acrylic or something, you'd use the 3 first, and then the 2, and finally finish up with the 1, which is the polishiest of them all. I use the 2 for just about everything. I don't even have a bottle of the 1, and the what little 3 I have is almost gone. So, yeah, the 2 is the red bottle, and it's the one I like the most. As far as contacts, you can clean them with a... The Flexstone files are good, which is sort of a like an emery board looking thing. A small contact file is good. If you have a newer game that's electronic, the manufacturer recommends you do not use these files on the gold-plated contacts, the idea being that if you use it, you're going to tear through the gold, and then it'll corrode faster and so forth. If you have an older game, you will find, if you take the contact apart and look at it up close with some magnification, the gold has been worn through. It's only a couple microns of gold flashing that goes on those. It's gone years and years and years ago, and there's no gold left where they actually touch anyway, and you can feel free to, as far as I care, to file it all you want, because it's, in my experience, doing it's not like they corrode the next day or even the next month or the next year. They work. It doesn't hurt much on an older game. Although, yeah, if you did have a brand new game, you can follow their instructions and take a business card or some thick cardstock and use that for your cleaner, for your file to clean the contacts, and that seems to work well. I'm trying to think of something else I clean. Yes?
Did you ever use a Dremel tool wire brush?
Dremel tool with a wire brush only? Very rarely. Very rarely. It's that's the kind of thing, you could take coarse rust off before you were going to if you had a board that was corroded, for example, a logic board where a battery had leaked, then I actually have a fiberglass brush I like for that, because it's because it does the job pretty quick without tearing through the copper very quickly. The Dremel is wonderful for getting in and cleaning little, you know, for doing jobs that saving you a lot of elbow grease. There's been times I've needed one. I just don't have one. There's a lot of times when you finally get a tool, you find out you wonder how you got along without it. And it's I haven't got a Dremel yet. My brother has one, and I've used it for a couple things, but I don't have it sitting handy where I use it right and left all the time. It's not something I carry with me. Yes?
Do you recommend waxing clear coated play fields?
Wax, yeah. Wax is clear coat. There's a lot of debate apparently about even what clear coat to use. There's people saying, no, we can't use the automotive ones because it doesn't expand and contract right with the wood. It's made to go on metal, et cetera, et cetera. And I think the reality, what people are going to find as time passes, the only way to find out is to do it and wait 30 years and see what happens, I guess, really. What I found in general is people who have bought brand new games, and this is even before they had the diamond plate playfield. People who have bought brand new games and put them in their home to play them, these games almost always look like they just came out of a time capsule. There's a Black Knight on the floor. So a gentleman brought a Black Knight that had been in the box for nearly 30 years and recently uncrated it. And so you look for it out there. You can tell which one it is. And you look at it and go, wow, this is just... And even it's nice to see the outside, but it's also nice to see the inside and all the electronics. The green is bright and shiny, and the metal tabs on the transistors are, you know, look like they were just plated, and everything that's plastic hasn't yellowed with age, and it was very gorgeous. It came from the era before the playfields were diamond plated, and it looks like brand new. However, I've seen many games in people's homes that they bought that were similar to that they bought new, and they've been playing them all this time, and they just don't wear out. You know, even though they weren't diamond plated, maybe there's a little bit of wear, you know, right where the ball kicks out here, or just a few ball crescents, which are the little C-shaped marks the ball leaves in the paint. They get a few of those in there, but my point is, it probably doesn't matter very much. You don't put enough miles on your game in your home to ever really wear it out, unless you're having. I've only had a couple customers that I looked at and go, they're playing this more than it would get played in a bar. What's wrong with this game? You know, why is this thing break? It's not breaking any more than a game in the real world. The guy just never stops playing it. You know, one was a retired guy, and I swear he got up in the morning. The first thing he did was play it and go till about, you know, 12 hours, and then he would take a break. It was just he was putting that many miles on his own game. But that's not normal. Most people, you know, coming on, they play it once a day or, you know, a couple times a week or when company's over or whatever. It's especially if you have more than one. You know, you divide the wear and tear amongst them. But Yeah, you can feel safe using wax, you know, a nice paste wax on just about anything. You're just putting a coat of it down, and it's there are some that can have like a yellowy buildup or with age, but you're not going to be doing it that often. I mean, it's in your home; they don't even get dirty that fast unless you're playing them an ungodly amount. Another thing my friend has is it's a pinball machine, not a shrine. It's not, you know, it's a. There's a lot of things on the market now that seem to be designed to keep your game from ever getting old, which is impossible. I mean, just having the game in your home will do that, even without those devices. You know, but personally, I don't worry about, you know, whether my hand is ever going to wear through the paint near the flipper button, or whether the legs are going to dent the cabinet a little bit where I tighten it down, because it's something, you know, I like just to have fun with them. Any other questions before I start talking about anything else? Now, yes?
Are you talking specifically about newer machines versus the older year machines?
As far as the clear coat, either way. A lot of people are taking older play fields and getting them clear coated before they put them in a game. And these would have been non-diamond plated play fields. They're spraying a finish similar to or identical to diamond plate, having it going out and having it done. There's various people providing this service now. And there's other people that are taking diamond-plated play fields and having them clear-coated. And I don't understand that at all, because if you look at the diamond-plated play fields, they don't wear out. And when I say they don't wear out, I mean, yeah, okay, after 15 years, you get a little chip right here where the ball comes out, or there's, you know, right on that insert there, you can see the crack and something. But I came from a time back when you were happy to have paint, you know, any paint at all in the area around the flippers. You know, you go look at old 8-ball deluxes and, you know, black knights and whatever. There wouldn't be, on a game that had really, really been played, you know, and operated, there wouldn't be any paint left down in, you know, in around the flippers. That was just the way it was. It was, the finish did not hold up. And so it's like I have no sympathy for these people that worry about having a tiny nick, you know, or one tiny flaw somewhere around that. So, yeah, but yeah, it applies really to either one, because people are putting clear coat on both kinds of play fields now, essentially making them all diamond plated or double diamond plated, I guess, in that case, or something like it. And yeah, and they're, you know, people are arguing online back and forth about which type of finish to use, and you know, try some yourself. I did my Fireball too. I tried some spray can stuff that was actually a Varathane product, and it was diamond finish something or other, and it's you know, it holds up okay, but it's primarily because the game comes to shows a few times a year and doesn't get played the rest of the time, more than any qualities that you know, any really benefit the finish gave me, because it is starting to wear around the pop bumpers, even just going to the shows. So I didn't bother putting the Mylars on. I kind of wanted to see what would happen, and I don't care if it wears much. Any other questions before I go? Before I change the subject? Yes?
How about adjusting the contacts? I've got EMs.
Adjusting on EMs, do you have a set of contact adjusting tools?
No.
This is a good thing to get. You can do it without them. You can use little needle nose pliers or other things, but a contact adjusting tool is essentially, it's a little like a stem with a. You can make one yourself. Take a piece of wire rod about maybe an eighth inch in diameter, maybe 3/16 inch diameter. Take a hacksaw and cut a slot in it. So now you can slide that onto the contact and you can adjust it up and down. They sell them usually as a set that you get them angled different ways, so you can reach into all the crazy places and bend the contacts. So those are very handy to have, and I can show them to you afterwards. I have a few of them here. The important thing with adjusting those is that they usually have, you'll see usually three blades. You'll have the one with a contact here and the one with a contact here. And then there'll be a stiff one. Sometimes they put it here, sometimes they put it there. And you don't want the one blade touching that to be floating around, fluttering around, so that when the ball hits it, it goes boing and flops around like this, because you'll get multiple switch closures or just they're designed to be controlled. Usually the one contact is sprung against a rubber if it's sticking up this way through the play field, or maybe a wire form if it's a rollover switch and it's got the wire form pushing on it this way. And so it's got a little spring tension against that to ensure it doesn't float. Because if it doesn't have that, then when, say, the ball hits a pop bumper, that switch is going to, it's going to bounce and make contact when you don't want it to, and you're going to get free points or something's going to get stuck. And then the other contact usually has a stiff blade under it to ensure that it, or above it, to ensure that it comes to rest firmly against that. So it's a shorter, stiffer blade of metal, and so you want each contact to be resting at something that keeps it controlled, so that, you know, has the freedom to move where it's supposed to, but it doesn't ever flop or hang limp somewhere. So you end up usually adjusting, you know, both of them till you get them the correct distance, and so they're sprung against whatever they're supposed to rest against. It is possible to put too much spring tension on those if you take your wrench and you can really crank on the upper one, and now you've got a contact putting so much tension on the wire form that the ball comes rolling down and hits the little pyramid-shaped wire form and just sits there because it doesn't gravity, the weight of the ball isn't enough to depress the contact, to depress the wire form anymore because the contact's pushing up on it so much. You'll find that also with games that have, those little round rollovers right in the middle of the playfield. Some are star-shaped, some are just round. It's pretty easy to get those to where either they're being pushed on so hard from underneath that the ball really, really has to bullseye them right for you to get credit for making the shot, or to have them hanging so limp that almost the weight of the rollover is threatening to give you points on that, and so you keep noticing every time you hit a bumper somewhere that it's registering this other thing. The adjustments are important, probably more so on electromechanical games, because they will, on an electromechanical game, if you stick a switch somewhere, it's going to hold something on. It's going to be turning on a reel, a score reel, and a chime, and those things are going to sit there and burn up. Whereas on an electronic game, generally, it just ignores that switch if it's stuck all the time. And so you don't have as much of a problem with that. It'll just be annoying to the player without hurting the game at all. Which reminds me of another question. Sometimes people ask me, what should I do? After I've gone out to their house, I fix things. They say, is there anything I should be doing to the game to fix it or to maintain it? Sort of, if you buy a car, they have a thing saying every 30,000 miles you should do this and every 3,000 miles you should do that. And if you look at the reasons that they give for those, they tend to be safety related or the manufacturer covering their butt as far as, they don't want you to come back and say it broke. And then they can point at you and say it was your fault because you didn't do A, B, and C. Primarily because they don't want you to get stranded somewhere. You should fix these things before they fail. Or there's a safety issue, or there's something that's going to turn into a very expensive problem if you wait. If you just drive, and never change the oil, it's going to get very expensive when it finally goes out. There's not many of those apply to pinball except for the cost one, and that tends to be the batteries. On almost all solid-state games, you have a battery back there that, if left unattended, and in my experience, it always eventually goes unattended. I mean, I have batteries at home. I know about this. And I went to pick up my TV remote the other day, and it didn't go. And I opened it up, and oh, man, and I got the battery's leaked, and it's corroded, and I have to clean it up and fix it because I can do that. But, yeah, that's the biggest threat is to your electronics in the back box.
In my Mata Hari, we had one burnout, and then we put and I think it was exactly that. The battery must have leaked onto the...
Yeah, they're horrible. They're just the nastiest things. Especially, you mentioned Mata Hari, uses the NiCad batteries. The Gottlieb and Bally games use the NiCad batteries. They're far more destructive because the damage can go wherever there's a trace for the corrosion to follow, as opposed to the alkaline batteries, which are not rechargeable, and they tend to do their damage just by gravity. Wherever the battery is, it's going to go drip down from there and wrecks up, but it will... It corrode things on the board, components, sockets that chips plug into, connectors that plug onto the board. On your game, it'll get down onto the lamp driver board and the connectors on the lamp driver board, and somebody has to go in there and take the wires out and strip and put new pins on and clean up.
Coming to you because we spent $600, got the board, put it in, and it smoked.
Yeah, you don't want... Yeah.
It's now not anything I want to ever get near.
Yeah, the batteries are just the worst thing ever. I mean, they're essential in some ways, that's one of the only bugs me. They weren't really essential. Atari did just fine without batteries, and their games always were able to keep high scores. What the battery does, they back up the memory when the power's off. They remember, your high scores, your replay thresholds, various bookkeeping things for the operator who wants to know how many coins went and how many free games he gave out that week or whatever. So, the battery... some games you can leave the battery out and you don't miss much. Mata Hari is a good example. You won't have your replay thresholds, but the game will play normally without that battery, whereas a lot of other games you really have a bunch of stuff that's programmed and it's not going to be much fun unless you keep that data every time you turn it off. But the batteries are the one thing that will turn into a very expensive proposition if they're allowed to just go unattended for forever, and then they finally leak and destroy things. So it's a good deal to either find a replacement for it, which in your game there's options, or... On like a Williams game, on the Bally games, I'm now using capacitors because you can get capacitors that can power the RAM for a reasonable amount of time. Very reasonable. In fact, I was surprised to find my Flash Gordon, which missed a couple shows, and I dragged it out after, I think, over a year and a half, still had the data for the RAM in it off that capacitor. And they're nice because they never leak and they never... I mean, okay, a capacitor even will fail eventually. It just won't do any damage when it does, and it'll take many, 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 many years before it goes bad. Yeah. And so for everybody else, it has to have a battery. If you have a WPC game, it has a real-time clock, and it draws a lot more current. It won't last nearly as long. Even Williams always liked to run a couple other chips for memory protection and whatnot, and they never ran very long off a capacitor. We had a Stargate, not a pinball, but a video game, and we tried doing that with the same kind of capacitor, and it would only go about a week before it would forget everything, which is useful for some places. I mean, if it was an arcade or something, they could do that because they turn the game on every day. But you know, the average person at home, they might go a week and not play their game, or a month. You know, they're away, or just, you know, they're bored with it for a little while, and it's a and even then, if you think you're on the ball, you know, you get busy, you get married, you have kids, and suddenly your pinball is just not that important. One day you wake up, your battery leak because it's just completely unimportant. I mean, eventually it always gets forgotten and raises a lot of trouble and expense. So the best thing you can do then, at least, is mount the battery not on the board, somewhere where it won't drip on things. So that's what we've been doing, just one by one with all the games at the museum, if, you know, when possible, is either getting rid of the batteries or putting them somewhere safe or whatever. You know, make sure they're screwed down. Put them in a socket and screw the socket down to something. Don't have it dangling by the wires and flopping around back there, because you can create new and exciting problems with that too. Oh, and don't screw the socket down onto anything metal. I say this because this was interesting. It was annoying when it happened, but it's most of the sockets you buy are these little plastic, you know, snap-in 3AA battery sockets, which they have a couple screw holes. The screw holes are under the outside two batteries. And in fact, you need to get nice countersunk screws, because if the screw head sticks up, there's not enough room to get the battery into the socket. So you buy just the right screws, and you go to screw it down, and let's say the game you're doing is Laser Q, or any of the other Williams games that have the metal lining all throughout the head. And you say, I'll put it right there, and you screw it down, and everything seems okay at first, and then you find out it won't remember anything, and you wonder why. And the answer turns out to be that the little tiny screws, that, you know, the ones that fit right, no matter how careful you are with a screwdriver, usually, you know, even if you drill pilot holes and you think you're being careful, the screwdriver raises tiny little welts in the metal, the screw head. It messes up the screw head just the tiniest little bit and raises little sharp places. And those sharp places will, when you snap the battery in, generally, over time with vibration, if not right away, they will pierce that plastic coating that's on the battery. Underneath that is the ground side of the battery. The three batteries are in series. You have the one that actually is touching ground. That one wouldn't matter. If it pierced that one, it wouldn't matter because it's grounded anyway. And then the middle one, and then the top one, so that you have, eventually you have 4.5 volts at this end. Okay. When the screw, which is in the metal lining of the game, which is grounded, pierces that upper battery, suddenly you have a short, and, you know, the battery will get very hot, and you know, it'll die instantly, and you lose your memory. And so, yeah, screw the battery socket down to something wood, and you just don't have this problem, even if that happens. Or use some socket that mounts in some other fashion. And if you have a Data East game, Guns N' Roses or something like this, don't attempt to cut the socket off with your wire cutters. The leads are not copper, they're steel or something, and immediately destroys your cutters. You know, you look at that, let's snip that off. Like, oh, I ruined my cutters. And I finally remembered not to do that last time I did one. Some of the interesting things we're seeing here, batteries are still the number one thing. In terms of dollars that have come my way in solid-state pinball, it had batteries would be the number one thing that fueled that. So that's another reason I say stay on top of that. You know, it's second things have mostly to do with age. They're age-related. You know, a lot of people can do simple things themselves. You know, okay, they replace rubber, they clean the play field, they changed any light bulbs they could find that were out. You know, but now they need the game to work. Among the most common problems on the solid-state pinballs anyway are connectors that fail with age. Or because of batteries. You have a battery in there, even the gas that's coming off the battery will eventually corrode things around them. And you have, you know, hundreds and hundreds of little pins which have a little knee-shaped bend in them, and they lose their spring tension with age, and they will break off at the knee with age, and they will corrode with age. And the game relies on those for it to work at all those connections. And it's so you can spend many hours, you know, checking out your connections, and they're often not... Often you can see them with the naked eye. You can unplug stuff and look at that and say, that's bad. But they'll fail. If you think about the average connection, it consists of, you got a wire, goes with a metal pin crimped onto it, and a bunch of those pins are stuffed into a plastic housing, and the whole thing snaps onto a connector on the board. So the connection can actually fail in many ways. The pin could be crimped poorly, or the crimp has gone bad with age, which is not as common. The pin can have broken off or have corroded, which happens actually kind of a lot. The pin could be making a poor connection to the other pin on the board, you know, the male pin sticking up out of the board because of, again, age, corrosion, et cetera, or the plating has come off the pin on the board. And the pin that's soldered into the board will crack where it solders into the board and get loose, and those have to be, you can either you know, resolder it or you can replace the whole row of pins all at once. Incidentally, I don't recommend resoldering. You know, you don't want to just remelt the solder that's there, or just blob on fresh solder. You know, get some flux and brush some flux on, and then which helps everything melt, even if it's old solder. Remove the old solder and put on some nice fresh solder. It'll look nicer, and it'll make a way better connection than having all the dirt and stuff that's mixed in with the old solder. But yeah, connections are one of the biggest things that we see with. You know, we did a bunch of them yesterday. Well, Wednesday, when we come in here and people drag stuff off that's been sitting around and fire it up and go to find out that the game did not survive the trip. And it's usually when you end up with something like that, the game worked, you moved it, now it doesn't work. There's some kind of connection issue at hand. And you can often find those, if you can't see them with the naked eye, you can find them by wiggling things, which is especially easy if we had a flash out there on the floor. And now it worked, now it wouldn't. Now it worked, now it wouldn't. And these are always the hardest things to find, are the intermittent problems, because you never know when it's working. You know, how do you know when it's fixed? Well, it's fixed when it goes forever and doesn't break. You know, but it's if it works 1 minute and not the next, then you have to be a little persistent. And on this game, fortunately, it worked. Okay, now we have it working. Now don't touch anything. You know, and then we went in the back and we wiggled things till it stopped working. And then, okay, you find out which thing you wiggle. It doesn't make it work anymore. If you're going to do tests like that, it's usually a good idea to remove the fuse for the solenoids, because the game, once the computer goes out to lunch, a lot of things are kind of free to do whatever they want because nobody's telling them what not to do. A lot of games will light. Williams uses a lamp matrix that's actually running the lamps with a much higher voltage than they think they're getting because they're not really on all the time. And it will turn, you know, if the computer stops running, it'll just send the full 18 volts to them, and they'll come on really, really bright, and you could blow out some lamps. Or it'll pull in solenoids, and you could blow a fuse or smoke a solenoid and stuff. So if you're trying to force it to crash, you probably want to pull at least a solenoid fuse out, if not the lamp fuse as well. And then you can wiggle stuff around and just, you know, crash the computer without hurting your game anymore. Then, you know, it's screwed up. But yeah, in this game, we're able to go around and wiggle, and very often it's chips in their sockets because Williams used a brand of socket, which was very, very miserable in the early solid-state games. And you go up there, and it's difficult because anytime you push on or touch the board, you're actually flexing the whole board. You know, it's hard to sit and push on it without the whole thing doing a little bit of flex. But if you take individual chips and just sort of try to rotate them in the socket like it was a bottle cap you're trying to unscrew, just gently, you can usually figure out which one it is and lower it down to just one chip, and you'll know, okay, this socket's bad. Although if it's one of those early Williams games, you probably just want to change all of them. Because they were, there was a brand called Scanby, which were just miserable sockets. And there's something that I tell people: if it says that on it, you automatically change all of them. You don't give them a chance. They're never going to be good. And they weren't great that great when they were new, but they with age they've gotten so much worse that it's not something you want to mess with. You know, of course, actually changing them then is a whole skill set you have to develop, because it's board work and you can do a lot of damage to a board if you don't have excellent soldering skills. So, you know, there's vendors out here that have junk boards and piles, and you can, you know, buy an old Bally lamp driver board for $5 and practice on it. You know, solder stuff onto it, take it off, and until you can do it without tearing traces up and whatnot. It takes a while, but you know, you're not risking anything there, and it's cheap. So there are some interesting problems we're starting to see here in the 21st century. Batteries have never gone away. They're not that interesting. But does anyone have a WPC system game? These would be late model games that Williams did, starting with Funhouse, right up until the end. Something I've seen popping up here that I hadn't seen as much. A common symptom with that game, people would complain that the game crashes, especially when they hit the flippers. They hit the flippers and the thing would reset. When people call with this problem, the first thing I have them determine is the problem in the game? If the answer is, well, it's sat in the same place for 10 years and now we just started doing this, okay, the problem's probably in the game. If they say, I just got it, you know, I bought it and I just got it home, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. If they just say, I just moved it out into the garage and now it's doing it, then maybe it's not the game. Because these games can do this even if they're perfectly fine. if there's a problem with the power or some other load on that circuit breaker. I once had a Twilight Zone in this bar, and it was on the same breaker as the refrigerator. They had a big old, like, I don't know if it was walk-in, but it was, you know, big wall of glass refrigerators, and it wasn't apparent at first. You know, I don't know how the bar is wired, and they don't know how it's wired, and all he knows is his game keeps resetting, and nobody knows why. But after a while of being in the room, I finally noticed, you know what, every time this does this, the lights dim a little bit. You know, it's just one of those things where just for the split second when the motor kicked in, they would dim, and finally I made the connection and said, this game is fine. You know, we went and got a really long extension cord and plugged it in upstairs somewhere, and then the problem went away. You know, but you'll drive yourself nuts if you're trying to find a problem with a game that the game doesn't really have. So that's the first thing you do, is find out if it's really the game or not. But yeah, there are numerous problems that the game can have which do the exact same thing. Most common is the bridge rectifier that eventually takes the AC voltage that makes the DC voltage that eventually becomes the 5 volts the computer runs on. And that's that was the most common, or in the early years, that was about the only thing that when these games were 3, 4, 5 years old, that's about the only thing we were seeing. On the wide body games, Twilight, not all of them. Judge Dredd doesn't have this, but Twilight Zone and Star Trek, they have this. They added an extra little board up in the corner, which required that they had a sort of this Y connector they stuffed in there, so they could run the 5 volts other places without altering harnesses they had already made up. And this, the computer ends up getting its power just through the craziest route. You know, the two connectors from the driver to the computer are about 2 inches apart, but they went and ran it all the way up here and down here and through this and came down and finally came back down to the computer. There's a connector that they added that causes a lot of problems with that, which we started to see go bad. But lately, the third one I'm seeing is just the connectors themselves, where the power leaves the driver board and enters the computer. They'll look generally fine, although the pins will usually be sort of a bronze color instead of the shiny chrome, nice, newly, freshly plated look that they have. They'll be this kind of metallic brown looking. Those are easy enough to prove because, it's doing it. Turn on the game, hit the flippers once, the game crashes. If you just unplug those and plug them back in a couple times and wiggle the wires, usually you can make it go away for quite a while, and then you'll know those connectors are bad. That's, it won't have fixed it permanently, but if you get it to go away at all, you know they're bad. And those are fairly easy to change, but you'll need pins and connectors. The nice thing is the internet has just popped up as this tremendous resource for all this stuff, all this information even. I mean, all this stuff is online now. There's wonderful pictures, and they tell you where to get tools and whatnot, and I can give you all that information if anyone's interested. But I mean, you look at some of the stuff on the tables out there, and I have a customer from nearly 10 years ago that they had a Gottlieb Universe, and the animation disc that spins was terribly, completely badly warped. Beyond any ability to flatten it, probably. It's I think because there's a metal part riveted to it. Anyway, and they're like, what can I do? It's like, wait for somebody to reproduce it. Well, it's happened. There's a guy out there from Australia with those discs, brand new, on the table. I mean, it's at no time ever has there been more parts available, reproduction boards and playfields even. I mean, I never thought anybody would reproduce playfields, which brings me to a third thing that we're starting to see here in the 21st century. Incompatibilities between third-party boards for games. I like my games to have the original board just because I'm stupid that way. I'm fussy and like I like it's just part of the experience. This is what this manufacturer had to do to make this work and make money for them and make money for the operator and to make the thing do what it's supposed to do for a reasonable cost. This is how they had to do that. Yeah, it generates a lot of heat and it's not as reliable as it's done today, but that's what they did, and that's part of sort of the complete game experience, not to the player. I mean, you can put a new board in, the player won't notice any difference, but I kind of like it as a technical thing. Nevertheless, the boards that are being made are wonderful in that they allow the average person who can change connectors to get in there and make their game reliable again without having to have, years and years of technical skill. Something that's been popping up now, however, is that the person who makes a board work with the Bally system doesn't necessarily test their, say, computer with the lamp board that some other person made, or the solenoid driver board that a different third party made. People aren't generally checking all of them. They've checked it with a lot of Bally games using original Bally boards, but I've heard of people now that are mixing and matching these third party boards in one game and getting some strange things to happen. So that's something to watch out for. I mean, any one of them is probably fine, but if you start mixing some of these from different things, you may have problems. Again, it's fairly uncommon, but it can happen. So it's another argument for fixing what you have, assuming the battery hasn't leaked and eaten it completely up already. Are there any other questions? Is it, what games do people have here? Huh? All EM games? Several? 19, that's a lot of EM games. It's the best thing you can have to fix any game, whether it's electromechanical or solid state, is the manual. With the EMs, it's just about all you need. If you understand, this is electricity and how it works, this is how a transformer works, and this is what it takes to make a light bulb come on, the schematic is almost all you need. And usually it's all you need to fix an electromechanical. With a solid state game, there's other things you need to know because the games think for themselves. And it's and that can get annoying. It bugs me, actually, and not just with pinball, but in real life, when they're building things that don't need to think, that start thinking. I had a problem with the power locks on a car door one time, and it's like there's an actual computer in there that looks for whether you hit the key. And I would rather have it just be something really stupid where I turn the key in and it directly drives the locks up or something. But you get, on a solid state pinball, there's a computer in there and it's making decisions, and it helps to have a little bit of experience knowing this is how it was supposed to work. Whereas on electromechanical, you can just look at the schematic and see this is how it must work. When this switch closes and that switch closes, this thing goes on. Whereas on a computerized game, you say this switch closes, the computer sees it close, the computer has a program which then determines in this state, if that switch is closed and the switch is closed and it's this point in the game, then I'm supposed to do this. And if you don't know what that is, then there's no way to tell whether it's doing the right thing other than... most late model games do have excellent tests that you can go in and say, okay, is the switch working? And you can go to a solenoid test and say, is the solenoid working? Yes, okay. The game has the ability to run this solenoid. The game has the ability to see the switch. The rest is up to the computer and software. It must be working right. There are different versions of software for each game. You can get the latest ones online. There's usually very few things you will actually notice from one to another. A lot of times it was very minor things or very rare things they were altering, or they added the coinage so Belgium could price the games according to their country, or little things like this. But every once in a while there's some revisions that, if you're paying attention, you'll notice there's obvious differences from one to the other. Well, usually they're very rarely obvious, but but they're out there. So if it's nice to have the latest software, just because in general it's the most likely to have the least problems. Something you don't have to worry with on an electromechanical game. Yes?
On one of Shaggy's podcasts, he's talking about that the designers of the boards and the games put hidden things in there that if you knew the special type of code to put on, I guess, on the dip switches, they did all kinds of weird things.
Yeah, these are Easter eggs. Easter eggs are something programmers put in the program because they're bored, and they want to make, it's just as easy to make it something where it's going to put it, if it was a video game, put your the designer's initials or name on the screen or something, write it in there, a lot of the pinball games have things, and most of these have been posted on, discovered and posted online, or leaked online purposely because players expect these now, and the manufacturer will see to it that they get out into the public and on the internet, and everybody can learn that if you... And usually it's something fairly elaborate, that if you hit some elaborate combination of flipper buttons and the start button or the extra ball button or whatever switches the game has at the player's disposal, it will then go, Star Trek The Next Generation does one. I used to know the pattern for it, and I don't anymore. But yeah, you do left, right, left, right, left, left, right, left, left, right, left. And then it would go and it would show all the different games Steve Ritchie had designed up until that point and put like a little logo of each one on the screen. Things like that. Or... there's lots of them. Williams used to hide cows in every game. It was sort of a gag they did from the middle to late 90s. It was a running gag where we'll hide a cow in every game. And there you'd be at some point in the game and you'd hear a moo or a cow would pop up on the screen or something. But there's other ways you could make them appear by hitting buttons. And so there's some fun things to discover. Although most of them, the elaborate button ones, you'll never stumble upon accidentally. You'd have to sit there and play with them forever. Kind of like the thousand monkeys with 1,000 typewriters will eventually bang out the works of Shakespeare. Yeah, if you get enough monkeys, enough pinball machines, they'll find all the Easter eggs. But they won't write them down and give them to you on a list or anything. So, you had mentioned electromechanicals, and I said that you could fix almost everything with the schematic. Every once in a while, you get a problem. The schematic falls just a little bit short. We had a game in Dixon, at the Dixon show this year. It was a Williams Honey. Yeah, Pinagogo, they had a Williams Honey, And we had this problem. The ball goes in the hole, and it's supposed to score. The first time you do it, like 1,000. The next time it was worth a little more, and next time worth a little more. And finally, 20,000, then it kicks it out and resets. And when it got to the highest value, it would sit there and score, you know, maybe 5,000 or 6,000 and kick it out. Sometimes it'd sit there and go 50,000, 60,000, 70,000 and just and never kick it out. And it would always eventually get it, but it was just completely random how many points you would get. And to compound the problem, the schematic they had was one of those blueprint ones that unfolds to be about 12 feet long. And we had to put it on the floor to see it in the light, and it was windy there. Anyway, we had to get things and put it on just so you could follow this up and down, and finally come down to just, well, look at these two switches on the motor. There's this one and that one. And if this one was to move just after this one, then it would work right. But no. But the two cams were identical. You know, they both had the notch cut in the same place, and the two switches are mounted just like that, so the two switches always go at the same time. You know, maybe I could try adjusting one so it's supposed to go afterwards, but that's just wrong. They don't do that. The manufacturer would not do that. They should have made it where the one had a notch so that this one opens, then that one opens, then it would work right every time. I'm looking at this. And then what does it mean here? The schematic had one word by one of those switch tacks that said forward. It's like, what does that mean, forward? It's like it's not like you can call somebody at Williams and ask. This was, 40 years, 45 years ago. And this is just the sort of things when you're fighting against, I wasn't there. I was born too late to know this. Fortunately, there's a lot of people at Pinagogo, and finally Sam Harvey came wandering over. I said, Sam, what do you know? What do you know about these things here, these motors? I want to know, how are these cams pinned to the shaft? Because maybe if you could rotate one a little bit, then it would be just right. And he said, oh, it's just a hexagonal shaft. They just slide on there. It's a hexagonal, so we could rotate it 60 degrees. That's too far, while he's explaining this. And he goes on to mention, oh, the other thing is that these switches mount, the switches have two screws holding them on, but there's three holes underneath. Underneath that stack of switches, there's three rows of holes, and you can put the switch here, or you can put it there. And then all of a sudden I realized what forward meant. That one switch, somebody has unscrewed it at some point and screwed it back so it's in line with all the others instead of being offset where it's supposed to be, which makes it open a little bit later than the other one. And it's, that's an example of something that they just – the schematic did have a clue. Okay, it had that one word forward, but none of us knew what it meant at the time. And I won't ever forget that one because we spent probably 3 hours before we got to that point and finally saw the light and unscrewed the screws, moved the switch over a spot, and then the game worked perfectly every time. And then later I went back to the shop and pulled out all my schematics from around that time to see if there are any others like that. And I did find at least one, and it said switch forward, which would have explained everything a little bit more. It's just one of those things that they're usually pretty good because they give you a breakdown on those showing the all the cams and what – how many degrees the notches in the cam are, and a little timing chart and stuff that you almost never need to refer to unless for some reason, in a frenzy, you took your game just completely apart without writing anything down and needed to reassemble it. That's the only time that information comes together, which I should also mention, those the hardest problems to find are those man-made problems like that. That's something that the game can't fail that way. The game can't unscrew the screws, move the switch over, and put it back down. It just doesn't happen. And those are always the most challenging, are either intermittent problems or something somebody did that was deliberate and you didn't know what it was. But anyway, we're out of time, and I can take any more questions you have outside, and we'll move on to the next speaker. But so, good.